Build that wall. Build that wall. Build that wall.
We all remember President Trump's early campaign rally promise.
We are going to build a great border wall to stop illegal immigration.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, December 16th, the status of the border wall today, what to expect for its future from a president-elect Biden. Then we look at sacred lands and ecosystems being destroyed where the border wall is being erected.
We are inhibiting the movement of many animals from a lot of their home range and also their migration and dispersal routes between the U.S. and Mexico.
And finally, are you wearing something comfortable right now? Because I am. We talk fashion and how it's changed during stay-at-home orders.
Clothing is something that we wear to signal to others that we understand the social situations that we're in and the expectations that come with them. So once those situations change, I think it gives everybody sort of psychological permission to explore their options a little bit.
But first, on June 16th, 2015, Donald Trump rode down the golden escalator at Trump Tower and announced he was running for president of the United States. He then made a campaign promise that would become a symbol of his presidency.
I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Mark my words.
Since then, President Trump has consistently pushed for the border wall and has continued to make false claims about the wall's efficacy over the past 4 years. Here is the president at a rally in Nashville in 2018.
But in the end, Mexico's paying for the wall. They make all of this money and they do absolutely nothing to stop people from going through Mexico, from Honduras and all these other countries, the caravan, all of this stuff. They do nothing to help us, nothing. They're gonna pay for the wall and they're gonna enjoy it, okay? They're gonna enjoy it.
And here he is at a rally in Arizona this past September.
It is just 30 feet high. It's very hard, very hard. We have anti-climb provision on the top. We have the whole deal and it's very powerful. And by the way, where that wall is, nobody's getting through. Nobody gets through.
But Mexico has not paid for any of the wall, and people are still managing to cross the border in places where the wall has been erected. Now, as Trump's time in the White House comes to a close, his administration is rushing to finish 450 miles of the wall before Joe Biden takes office. Biden, meanwhile, has pledged to stop construction of the wall. President Trump's signature border wall, what it was meant to do, what it did, and what its future could look like. Zolan Cano Youngs is a Homeland Security correspondent for The New York Times, and he joins me now. Zolan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate being here.
So lots of talk about building a wall. Where does the wall stand now, Zolan? How much of it has actually been built?
Yeah, so right now there are about 430 miles of border wall that the Trump administration has constructed. Now, nearly all of those miles, with the exception of roughly 30, are in places where some previous form of infrastructure, wall, border wall infrastructure existed. Now, what does that mean? What I mean is, in all but roughly 30 miles of that 430, so about roughly 400, the border wall was built in places where a dilapidated form of barrier or Normandy barriers that could stop vehicles that maybe cross through the border. That's where most of the border wall has been constructed. On top of that, most of the border wall thus far has been constructed on land that was already owned by the federal government because of private property owners, landowners, who have actually pushed back against this construction. And what that means is that this construction has, for the most part, impacted federally owned land that came in the form of environmental areas, areas like archaeological sites, areas where there were endangered species that called that land home. Now, with that being said, all the total of 430 miles. And I should say, the Trump administration is still going. They're still building. They are likely to meet that 450-mile mandate that the president earlier this year said that he would complete by the end of the year. But of course, as you know, and as you cited in that intro, the goalposts for this project have moved throughout the first term of the Trump administration. This is not a wall that will extend from sea to shining sea, and it is one that has impacted the finances of the U.S. federal government as opposed to accepting any sort of check from Mexico.
Let's talk about that, Zolan, because who's paying for it ultimately? Mexico doesn't seem to have paid for it as much as the president told his supporters that they would.
The Trump administration was able to secure about $15 billion for the border wall. That would go towards about 731 miles of that construction. That's U.S. taxpayer dollars. And it's not as simple as that. You know, Customs and Border Protection and Army Corps of Engineers are the two entities that are really participating in this construction. But as you remember, this project resulted in Congress did not agree to provide the president with all of the money that he wanted for this project in 2018. It resulted in a government shutdown and subsequently a national emergency declaration by the president. That allowed him to then transfer money from the Defense Department. Billions of dollars from the Defense Department.
That was about $6 billion we're talking about, right, Zolan?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And this isn't just bureaucratic process. Let's talk about where that money was coming from. You know, the president has said that this wall was meant to stop human smugglers, drug traffickers, criminals from coming into the country. That $6 billion in part actually came from counter-narcotics programs that the Defense Department had. It was also going to be money that was going to be used for construction projects for the Defense Department, construction projects that would improve the infrastructure for certain Defense Department initiatives. But also, it's important to put a sort of human face on this, too. I mean, that money was also going to go towards building a new school for military families as well. My colleague Colleen Cooper wrote about that. So this is definitely sucked up the resources of multiple facets of the U.S. government.
And at the end of the day, I mean, you said that this was a promise that the president made to keep drug cartels out of the country and people who are engaging in human trafficking. Americans are living on the southern border, of course. How do they feel about the wall? Do they feel safer because of it?
Well, it's varied. It's definitely varied. You will have some folks, you know, my colleague Simone Romero just and I just did a story in Arizona where this project has very much pitted rancher against rancher in a way, because there are some who do support this border wall, who say that illegal migration is an issue and it has been for years in the United States. I go to an individual that I talked to in South Texas, which if you go by the president's proclaimed measure of success here in stopping illegal migration, then there's no other place where you would think that they would hone this project in on than South Texas. It's been the hot zone for illegal crossings in recent years. That's actually been where they've struggled to build new wall as opposed to places like Arizona. The reason for that is because private property owners have pushed back. They have actually, gone to court and enlisted lawyers to say, no, we are not going to allow you to build this wall that will cut through my farmland. I think of an individual I interviewed, Richard Drawway, who is a staunch supporter of the president. He very much bought in to his message of restricting immigration to the United States. And when I went to go visit him, and he is right on the border in South Texas in the Rio Grande Valley, when I asked him about the border wall, he went to his farm and pulled out a ladder, a rope ladder. And he said, essentially, I'm paraphrasing here, but he was saying, I don't realize why this is the response here. Migrants are still going to use ladders to get over this wall. We have seen through reporting that we have done, as well as our competitors, that there are still many who are cutting through the border wall. as well, using
and
tools.
And Zolan, are a lot of these folks coming because they're fleeing persecution? Because are they, do we know who are is continuing to come? Because we know that the Trump administration has also put in pretty draconian rules and laws as far as who is it allowed to plead asylum in this country, for example. So are people who are attempting to cross the border despite the wall right now and any other physical barriers, do we know who they are?
Well, let's be clear. When you talk about migration to the U.S. border, in recent years, specifically the years in the Trump administration, what we are talking about for the most part are Central American families who are fleeing poverty, persecution, and violence. They are coming from predominantly the Northern Triangle countries, making that journey north and stepping on U.S. soil to ask for asylum. We saw that demographic shift away from what had traditionally been single adult individuals from Mexico, maybe seeking economic opportunity, to now families that were surrendering to Border Patrol agents when they stepped on U.S. soil in order to ask for asylum. So it's a great question. We should just note here that when the president says this is necessary to keep out, you know, hordes of criminals and what have you, even the top officials in Customs and Border Protection would say that a majority of the individuals trying to cross the border are families seeking a type of sanctuary in the United States.
We have a new administration, Zolan, as you know, taking office next month in January. Joe Biden has pledged to stop construction on the wall. What does that actually mean? Is he going to just stop where the Trump administration leaves off? Is he going to attempt to dismantle what's already been built?
You know, for me, the question, I mean, Joe Biden's statements thus far on what he's going to do with the border wall brings up more questions than answers. So he has said that he will not construct one more mile of border wall. We know that. In reporting that I've done, talking to those close to his transition, I mean, thus far, it does not seem there are any plans whatsoever to dismantle the wall that has already been built. That would be incredibly expensive, and it just does not seem likely at this point. But there's also some more questions, right? Just the other day, Customs and Border Protection officials, including Acting Commissioner Mark Morgan, held a press call and started to tell reporters that, you know, just stop. And mind you, I mean, these officials have also been advocating for President Trump's immigration policies in the past couple of weeks and openly criticizing the policies of the incoming Biden administration. But they basically told reporters, look, stopping border wall construction is not as easy as it sounds. We do have contracts with these companies. That's true. There are likely going to be termination fees if you just halt construction with those companies. That would also be U.S. taxpayer dollars. Also, what do you do in the situation like in South Texas, where you actually have to dig dirt and construct into a river levee in order to start constructing the border wall? Will you now need to go back and basically make sure that that river levee is built enough, is sturdy enough so that it could withstand any sort of flooding? So there's a lot of questions and likely going to be some fees with just an immediate halt on border wall construction.
Not a clear solution right now. We'll pay attention as this evolves. Zolan Cano-Youngs is Homeland Security correspondent for The New York Times. Zolan, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Construction of the wall has not only affected immigration to the United States, it's also wreaked havoc on the natural world, from endangering sensitive ecosystems to destroying sacred burial sites. Environmental and indigenous activists say the border wall has been devastating for people and wildlife in the region. For more on the cultural and ecological impact, I'm turning to Miles Traphagen, Borderlands Program Coordinator for Wildlands Network, based in Tucson, Arizona, and a tribal member of the Chickasaw Nation. Miles, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on, Tanzina.
Miles, how would you characterize the physical environment and landscape of the borderlands?
Well, the borderlands, I think, are often misunderstood by people who don't live in them. I think that the perception is usually that it's a desert wasteland and flat and sandy, you know, like, you know, picture, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, the sand dunes blowing across the desert, but nothing could be further from the truth. It's a highly varied landscape that ranges from a low desert scrub with saguaro cactus, the iconic species you see in the West, ranging up to 10,000-foot mountain peaks with Douglas fir and Engelmann spruce and ponderosa pine. And then, of course, in between, we have vast grasslands, which you know, bison still roam in between Chihuahua and New Mexico. And then there's a great diversity of mammals and reptiles and plant species in this area. Some of the highest biodiversity levels on North American continent.
How threatened are is this region right now because of the border wall, Miles?
This is the most extreme threat and the greatest impact, ecological impact, that we've ever seen here. Essentially, what's going on is that we are conducting, society is, the Trump administration, inadvertently, an ecological experiment. Because what's happening is that we are dividing the North American continent by a border wall. And that's simply never occurred in the evolutionary history of North America. So essentially what we're doing is that we are inhibiting the movement of many animals from a lot of their home range and also their migration and dispersal routes between the U.S. and Mexico.
What about flora of the borderlands, the plant life that you described, the cactuses? Are they also at risk?
Yes, in a place specifically Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument, and that's in western Arizona. The monument was established for the protection of the Organ Pipe Cactus, which reaches its northern limit from Mexico in this area. What they've done, they started doing this last year, is they raised a 60-foot wide road on the north side of the border, known as the Roosevelt Easement. And the Roosevelt easement was set aside by Theodore Roosevelt, a 60-foot buffer between the border and Mexico. So they began bulldozing the cactus and, you know, all the vegetation along this strip. And what makes this particularly troubling is that they don't have to do any environmental review. There's no environmental impact statement required, no NEPA process, which is the National Environmental Policy Act. So the Department of Homeland Security can essentially waive all laws in order to build border walls. And that's specifically what they've done for this entire strip along the border.
Miles, the construction crews have also come very close to, if not have destroyed, sacred indigenous sites. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, exactly. And that's in the Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument area. There's a place called Monument Hill, and this was the traditional burial ground, one of the burial grounds for the Tohono O'odham Nation. And the tribe's ancestral lands and current lands span both sides of the border in the U.S. and Mexico. So they were essentially divided by the border. You know, there's an expression here in the borderlands that say, we didn't cross the border crossed us. So what they did was to build the border wall is they blasted through Monument Hill. And to really add insult to injury, this occurred as Chairman Ned Norris was actually testifying on the Hill about this issue, the day that they were blasting through this. So everybody who's been following what's happening on the border and what the Trump administration is doing and its contractors, it's just you can't ignore that it appears as though there's a degree of spite in this. And that's the really sad part, is that, you know, the border wall was entirely unnecessary when we had levels of immigration at their lowest in decades. And they had essentially shut off most migration, illegal immigration and drug smuggling through electronic means and surveillance and ground scanning radar and night vision. So this has all just really come as a horrible shock to watch the destruction of our borderlands for such an unnecessary reason.
Miles, is all of the land that's being worked on right now going to be used for the wall?
We don't think so. And this is particularly sad because currently they are blasting, you know, mountains in wilderness areas and protected areas, areas of critical environmental concern, in order to build access roads for a border wall. So a lot of this region, the mountainous portions, are inaccessible to a vehicle. And in fact, some of these slopes are so steep that a person couldn't even walk up them. So instead of incorporating the natural features, like they basically did with the Great Wall of China during the Ming Dynasty, you know, we're blowing up these landscapes and essentially providing more access for illegal activity were it to occur. And on the ground right now, Border Patrol agents are reporting that smugglers are already taking advantage of these newly carved routes into places that were previously inaccessible.
Tell us a little bit about what water sources like the Rio Grande and even parts of the Colorado River, how they might be affected.
Well, the Rio Grande and the Colorado River will not be terribly affected in terms of water withdrawals. Some of the issues that we may see in the lower Rio Grande Valley is that they've constructed walls in places in the floodplain. And so there could be, you know, catastrophic, devastating floods that occur after, you know, the next hurricane comes around. But the real problem with water in the Borderlands region is the withdrawal of groundwater, specifically in Arizona. And the first place to really be impacted by this was Quito Baquito Springs at Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument. And it's been there for thousands of years, and it's a traditional watering source for indigenous people and for wildlife.
Miles, what about legal challenges from the environmental advocates and indigenous communities about the construction of the wall? How far have those gotten?
Well, I'd have to say that we won our cases. The Southern Border Communities Coalition and the Sierra Club, along with other environmental groups, along with a separate lawsuit that was enjoined to that lawsuit that was filed by the state of California, Attorney General Javier Becerra, and 19 other states. Those lawsuits prevailed in the Ninth District Court and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So they basically said that it was illegal to take funds from the Department of Defense when Congress did not allocate those funds. So basically, the Trump administration was not happy with the fact that Congress had only allocated $1.875 billion for border wall construction. So Trump declared a state of emergency and robbed the DOD of their funds. So despite the fact that the courts ruled and put forth injunctions and then summary judgments with injunctions, the Supreme Court stayed those injunctions. And in legalese, a stay means that they basically lifted the injunction and allowed construction to proceed until they decide the case. So the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear this case in the spring of 2021. And that's just entirely too late because, you know, as we're speaking right now, they are detonating mountains and wilderness areas with dynamite.
There is an incoming Biden administration. Miles, are you hopeful that that might be something that will change the trajectory in advance of the legal fights that you're saying might be too late?
Yes, I am. And we all urge the Biden administration to halt border wall construction on January 20th when he takes office and to not build any more border wall. And in fact, beyond that, there are places where we really need to remove these structures because they are going to halt the flow of many species, some of which are endangered, some of which are common everyday residents. But never before, like I said earlier, have we seen a barrier that's been placed across the North American continent that has the ability to just alter the entire evolutionary history of the continent.
Miles Traphagen is the Borderlands Program Coordinator for Wildlands Network and a tribal member of the Chickasaw Nation. Miles, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzine. I really appreciate it.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Over the past 5 days, the Trump administration has released a number of changes to U.S. asylum policy that are set to go into effect before the term ends. Some of the changes include denying asylum claims based on gender and sexuality persecution, or even persecution from organized crime. It also includes many procedural changes for immigration judges, opening the door to more asylum denials. I spoke with Aaron Reichlin Melnick, policy counsel at the American Immigration Council, and he told me about the new rules and what they mean for asylum seekers.
The rule makes a number of changes, both procedural and substantive, to asylum law that would restrict the ability of both migrants arriving at the border and people who arrive on visas to seek asylum.
And that includes people who are fleeing their country due to gendered violence or gang violence, right?
Gender will generally not be a ground for granting asylum. And importantly, the government hasn't explained how that might affect people who are seeking protection on the basis of their gender identity, including transgender individuals and gender non-binary individuals. These rules could potentially severely restrict the access to protection for LGBT individuals, although that would require negative interpretations of the regulations from immigration judges.
You say this rule is sweeping. How so?
Some of the biggest changes the rule makes are restrictions to the traditional definitions of asylum. One of the easiest ones to explain are changes to what it means to be persecuted on behalf of your political opinion. Under the proposed rule, it declares that the only person who can receive protection for persecution on account of political opinion is someone whose political opinion is about the control of a government. So what that means is that if you're a Saudi women's rights activist and the Saudi government is persecuting you for your political activism on behalf of women's rights, so long as you are not advocating for the overthrow of the monarchy, the Trump administration's rules would bar you from seeking asylum on that basis. Similarly, the rules impose sweeping new restrictions on eligibility for minor situations like crossing the border without permission, failure to pay even a cent of taxes, or in one of the most absurd situations, traveling through at least two countries before arriving in the United States without seeking asylum there, even if you were just traveling through an airport. So under the rules, an LGBT individual from Uganda, a country where homosexuality is illegal, who took the cheapest flight to JFK Airport, requiring them to transfer through Kenya and the United Arab Emirates, would start their asylum process with a negative mark against them because they failed to apply for asylum in Kenya or the United Arab Emirates, both of which are countries that ban homosexuality as well. This is an absurd interpretation that would particularly hurt those who can't afford a more direct flight, potentially leading to people being denied asylum just because they chose the cheaper flight option.
Now, Aaron, if this goes into effect 5 days before the inauguration, what's the point?
For generations, the United States has been a beacon of hope for those in need of protection. But this rule breaks that tradition. And by choosing to move forward with the regulation just 5 days before the new administration takes over, the Trump administration is making clear that deterrence through cruelty is the point until the bitter end. An administration that began its time in office with the Muslim ban is ending with another illegal attack on people seeking protection or seeking to move to the United States.
Can you give us an example of what would happen for someone who's traveled a long distance to get to the United States to request asylum?
Those individuals would now be placed into what's known as asylum and withholding only proceedings, which under this other rule, they would only be given 15 days to submit an asylum application. Now, if that person was seeking asylum on the basis of domestic violence or gang violence, where their country was unwilling or unable to protect them from that violence, something which has been a successful ground of asylum for years, this rule would block that almost completely. Under the new rules, any person seeking asylum on the basis of gender or on gang violence would be effectively barred from protection because the new rule declares that those grounds will generally not support a grant of asylum, even though thousands of people have successfully won asylum on those grounds in recent years.
How quickly would the Biden administration be able to undo this rule if they take over just a couple days after it takes effect?
It's almost certain that this regulation is going to be challenged in court. And because the changes it makes are so sweeping and so unjustified, it's likely that a court is going to block it before it goes into effect. If that happens, then the Biden administration would both have to agree not to fight that lawsuit and take steps to not only eliminate this new restriction, but put into place new rules which would protect the asylum system from bad actors like the Trump administration, should a new administration in the future take over, and what to make similar changes.
Aaron, you mentioned that this could end up in court. Where could it end up in court? And the reason why I'm asking you that is because we know one of the things that the Trump administration has done effectively is essentially reshape our courts and appoint many judges during the past 4 years. So where do we think this case could end up in court? And how do you expect that it would play out?
While I don't have any personal knowledge of where people are planning to file these lawsuits, it's important to note that there are some bedrock principles of agency administrative law that would block this rule no matter which judge sees it. In fact, we have seen with other Trump administration restrictions at the border, including asylum restrictions, that even judges appointed by President Trump have recognized that the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security have gone so far beyond the normal regulatory process and stretched the law so badly that the rules have been struck down.
So Biden takes over in January, at the end of January. What happens next?
Again, it's going to depend on what the state of that regulation is. Has it been blocked in court or not? But importantly, this isn't the only change that the administration is making to asylum in the last days. The Trump administration finalized a regulation that would impose a 15-day deadline to file asylum applications to migrants who arrive at the border, meaning that even those who speak no English, have no resources, and have no lawyer would be required to complete a 12-page asylum application in English and submit it just 15 days after their first court hearing. And another rule finalized earlier would allow the Trump administration to impose a $975 filing fee on appeals of deportation orders, taking the opportunity to seek an appeal from a deportation order out of reach for many. So we're going to see that the Biden administration is going to be faced with a raft of policies that it is going to have to move quickly to reverse and to ensure that we continue to follow our longstanding obligations to protect the vulnerable.
Aaron Reichlin Melnick is policy counsel at the American Immigration Council. Aaron, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ooh, make yourself comfortable, baby.
Hey, everybody, you're back with The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. So what are you wearing right now? If you're lucky enough to be working from home during the pandemic, it's probably something comfortable, maybe with an elastic waistband. Or maybe you're one of the many Americans wearing a dress shirt and pajama bottoms for Zoom calls. From sweatpants to slippers, the pandemic has changed a lot about the way we dress. I have a pile of leggings and track pants in my closet that I cycle through. And while I've amassed a small collection of furry warm slippers, I often host the show barefoot from a coat closet. I also have a growing collection of fashionable masks, which means I rarely wear lipstick anymore. Amanda Mull is with me from The Atlantic. Amanda, it's not just me, right?
No, it's not just you. I am currently waiting for a snowstorm outside of my window in a caftan that is technically a beach cover-up. So
a holdover from the summer of caftans and house dresses, I presume.
It is. It is. We have all sort of had our sense of what is appropriate and when knocked sideways in the past year in a lot of ways, but also in how we present ourselves.
So let's talk about that, because what do we know about how different types of clothing sales have changed? My sense is, just from my own experience, that denim sales and hard pants, as we call them, are not selling right now. Am I right?
Yes. The apparel market in general is having sort of a hard time and has been having a hard time all year, because a lot of the things that we buy clothes for are sort of created situations in which we feel that we need a particular outfit to telegraph a particular thing. Clothes are a social language, so we have a lot of situations in which we need very specific options. The pandemic has foreclosed on many of those options in many of those occasions. So we now live, most people now live in a much narrower set of circumstances. Even if you're going into work, a lot of your social activities are going to be different in your off hours. So it's really narrowed what people can find reasons to wear. And that means that a lot of like office type clothes, a lot of formal clothes, things like that, sales of those are way down. Sales of things you wear in your house, way up. There was one, especially early in the pandemic, I think it was Walmart, who said that they sales of pants had bottomed out for them, but shirts were still selling well, because that's what you can see on a Zoom call.
That's what I was going to say. And now we heard from some callers, and I know that for women and men, there may be some differences here, but are women and men generally, all of us, sliding into more comfortable gear as we work from home, those of us who are lucky enough to work from home?
Yeah, I think that this is a pretty widespread thing. It'll differ a little bit depending on industries, and some industries have different sort of gendered expectations for how people will dress when you can see them. It wouldn't surprise me if like law and banking and things like that were a little bit different than other types of office work, because they're more formal in regular times. But I think clothing is something that we wear to signal to others that we understand the social situations that we're in and the expectations that come with them. So once those situations change, I think it gives everybody sort of psychological permission to explore their options a little bit. And we've been in this for so long at this point that I think everybody has started doing that.
Now, I think what's interesting here is the psychological shift, the way you're talking about what clothes do for us psychologically. And I wonder if, I mean, for myself, I do two changes of clothing a day, one to come into, quote unquote, my office, i.e. my closet, because it sort of sets the tone. It says, I'm going to work right now. And then one after work, where I can run around with the baby and run errands if I need to. Is that something, are there people who need that psychological shift to say, I'm putting on foundational garments, and even if it's comfortable clothing, it's still professional enough to be able to do my job and then shift? Or are many people just kind of staying in their sweats all day and kind of, you know, the days blur and you're not sure what you've worn for the past week?
There are lots of examples of people doing both of these things. For some people, we live in built environments, the built environments of our homes, our offices, things like that. But our clothing and our wardrobes are also sort of a built environment that we create for ourselves in order to, you know, to signal to others, but also to reassure and sort of shore up our understanding of ourselves. So for some people, it helps them mark time to change clothes in the morning into their work sweats, and then change again in the evening into their nighttime sweats, or into the outfit that they wear when they cook dinner or something like that. So I think that a lot of people use clothing and use changes of clothing in that way. And then there are people, and I am one of these people, because I have worked from home on and off for years, who just, whatever is around, whatever is comfortable, I am willing to put that on and wear it until it seems like I should probably change my clothes for my own sanity.
Sanity is critical these days in any form that it comes. Amanda, what about, I mean, there are some changes, I'm wondering if they'll stick. And, you know, we're sort of laughing a little bit about the sweatpants and track pants and leggings. But I wonder, things like women who have said, you know, I'm not wearing a bra anymore, or I'm not wearing a bra that has underwire, or women in particular, and maybe some men who have said, I'm going to stop dyeing my hair. I'm going to just stop fighting this and let it be natural. Are there going to be people who decide that that's the way they move forward? Or are we going to go back to that type of pressure potentially when we're back in the office with each other?
I think that this is a very individual thing, because it sort of depends on what people had been already contemplating before all of this happened, and what their options are afterward. People who work in industries with really stringent dress codes probably can't change as much as somebody like me who works in media. And how does a writer dress anyway? Nobody knows. So you get, I think the biggest changes that we're going to see are when particular circumstances of the pandemic collide with a trend that was already picking up steam. Like for the past 10 years, underwire bras have been sort of out of style, and a lot more lingerie companies have started making good supportive bras that are a little bit more comfortable, that aren't necessarily meant to push up or mold you as much as a hard cup underwire bra is. So those had already been becoming more popular and more available to people. So I think that when you get a trend like that colliding with the circumstances in which a lot of women who might have still been wearing underwires every day have permission to stop doing that, I think that is where you get the greatest uptake and the greatest opportunity for like a real shift in how people view what they wear every day.
How are people adapting their clothes and their makeup for being on camera all the time versus being in person? I mean, it just, you know, there are days when I look at my Zoom appearances and think, my God, and that was after I put on a full face of makeup.
I talked to a guy who owns a video equipment store for a story earlier this year who said something to me that sort of made all of this click, because what camera sensors pick up and what our eyes pick up are two totally different things. They're related, but they're not the same. So you can look in the mirror and think, I look great. I look, you know, I would be confident going into a meeting like this. And then look at yourself on Zoom and go, what is going on?
Which is me pretty much every Zoom. Yes.
So I think that people are probably becoming more cognizant of what kinds of colors flatter them, like if they're warm toned or cool toned. You know, I'm a lot more cognizant of what my hair is doing. I have gotten a little bit better with the hairspray since this started. So I think that being forced to stare at ourselves is brutal, and it makes you evaluate your makeup and your hair and your clothing in a really different way. I will not go on a Zoom call without doing my eyebrows now, because I look a little bit dead if mm-hmm. I don't do my eyebrows. Mm-hmm. So these are things that if you aren't in a situation where you have to stare at your face all day, you just don't know about yourself.
You know, and I find that that's really interesting. A couple of years ago, I was asked by Quartz magazine to the website to make predictions about what the world would be like in 2050. And one of the things they asked was, what are people going to be wearing? And I predicted a rise in the popularity of athleisure clothing. And who knew? Who knew that I was so right? But this was really before the pandemic, when I noticed that a lot of people, myself included today, I'm wearing Adidas track pants and I'm not going running. I think that's also become a staple of American fashion, if you will. And I think, you know, I wonder if you see the industry headed more in that way. You talked a little bit about this with underwire bras, but is our clothing going to become more athleisure-y, I suppose?
I think so. I think a lot of it will. What you've got with athleisure is an interesting intersection of like fabric technology and cultural things that exist outside of clothing intersecting. And because a lot of the leggings and things like that, especially that we have now, are fabrics that just didn't exist a generation ago. And they've gotten a lot better in the past 10 years. So you can create these types of garments that sort of mold the body, but are still comfortable to wear, and that have much cooler designs, or are much better at picking up color than anything that our parents had growing up. It's just these things just simply didn't exist. So now that they exist, people are figuring out how to use them, how to wear them, what they're good for. They were developed for athletic stuff, but there's a long history in the United States going back to the turn of the century of things that are used in athletic wear then becoming things that are worn to the office. Because things that are used in athletic clothing are comfortable, they're breathable, you can move around in them easily. And there's a real social cachet in being associated with exercise and with fitness and with maintaining your body that way. So you've got the social norms of exercise being good and exercise being something that you want to demonstrate that you understand and do, combined with these new fabrics and these new ways of making clothes. And I think that we're only at the beginning of that.
I'm wondering if there's going to be, if after the pandemic, if there are going to be one of two responses, one where folks say, you know, even people who may have worked in industries like you cited, in law and perhaps in banking, where things are a lot more conservative, maybe folks saying, you know what, I'm going to take it down a notch. I'm, you know, casual Friday might be every day, right? Folks who have to go into the office and just we'll see a sort of resurgence or a rise in casual workwear. Or I'm wondering if the opposite is going to happen, where people are so tired of wearing leggings and sweatpants and not being able to express themselves as much as they want through fashion, that we'll see more fashion, you know, coming to the fore when people are able to buy things and show them off in public. What do you think?
I think that there will probably be instances of both of those things, but structurally, I think it's hard to go back once you've gotten people used to a certain level of comfort. I think that there will definitely be a lot of people who want to go out and wear a party dress and want to go out and wear a great pair of heels or buy a fantastic suit and just remind themselves that there's stuff beyond their own home. So I think that happens on an individual level, but structurally, when you look at how offices enforce how people are supposed to look in the office or expected to look, on days that are not casual Friday, we were already sort of in a long arc of casualization in American professional dress that has been going on for over 100 years. And I think that we were already to the point where it was fine to wear leggings and things like that in a lot of American offices, especially in offices that employ a lot of people in their 20s and 30s. So in a lot of tech stuff. And tech offices tend to be very influential in how other types of businesses eventually adopt their practices in their offices. So I think that this is another thing like underwire bras, where this was already sort of headed in that direction anyway. And the pandemic just provided a sort of an explosive moment for it to get really broad uptake that might have taken longer in normal times. But so I think that probably everybody's going to casualize a little bit because of this, at least at work.
Long live leggings. Amanda, one thing I miss is wearing lipstick. Maybe not a whole face of makeup, but definitely lipstick because of my masks. Are you hearing that from folks who wear lipstick?
There's a lot of little special things that people do for themselves that people think are fun. And I think that lipstick is a fun thing that people do that they like doing. So I think that some of these dressier things are things that people will excitedly return to when we all can take our masks off.
Let's hope so. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Amanda, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
From tracksuits to sweatpants to work pajamas, everything is in play now, and you told us about it.
Hi, Tanzina. My name's Amelia Chapelo, and I'm an Australian. I live in New York, and I love listening to WNYC. So at the moment, my lockdown fashion is about suits or sweats. I have three pair of matching sweats. So I have a black pair with a hoodie. I have a leopard print gray pair. And then I also have a beautiful mustard yellow. I love you, Sharu. Bye.
Hi, this is Margarita Zamora Saunders calling from Oakdale, California. And I have to say that my sense of fashion has gone out the window since the pandemic started. Before the pandemic, I would dress up, you know, wear high heel shoes, slacks, or nice dress to work when I would, you know, go into the office. Now, since I'm working remotely, I pretty much either wear leggings, joggers, or even keep my jammy bottom pants on from the waist down. And on top, I dress up usually with a decent looking blouse, but I definitely put a little bit of makeup on and do my hair. Anyway, that's my pandemic fashion for you.
Hi, this is Joel from East Bay, Northern California, just outside of San Francisco. My clothing attire has definitely changed since I started working from home in the middle of March. My wardrobe has reverted back to that of a 12-year-old boy. Shorts, t-shirt, and a hooded sweatshirt every day.
And we've got one more piece from Allie Pinnell, who works with us here at WNYC, and she sent us one of those voice memos.
Hey, this is Allie calling in from Brooklyn. My COVID style has changed. I used to be a dress wearer because it just forced me to pick one thing and then my outfit was set. And since COVID hit, I've been investing in cozy but nicer sweaters and have been wearing pretty much the same two pairs of tracksuits over and over. They're light. They enable me to cross my legs and change my sitting position. And I don't know if I will keep wearing this back in the real world, but I've definitely invested more in my upper body look.
Very nice, Allie. Remember, send us a voice memo like that, record it right on your phone, and send it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.